From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, rediscovering neglected works by Gershwin, Copland, Schubert, Paul Bowles, and other composers. We talk with Jonathan Scheffer, the founder, conductor, and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra. Also, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Shipler. His new book is about the working poor, or as he puts it, the people who serve you Big Macs, help you find merchandise at Walmart, harvest your food, clean your offices, and sew your clothes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Iraq, 47 Iraqis were killed today when a suicide bomber blew up his car outside an Iraqi recruiting center. This is the second such attack in as many days. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Baghdad.
The Iraqi Governing Council said the two attacks aimed to destabilize Iraq and impede the transfer of sovereignty to Iraqis. According to the council, the insurgents want to keep Iraq occupied and kill hopes of establishing a democratic system. Some Iraqi survivors said they were even more determined to defend the new Iraq, but others expressed fury with the Americans, blaming them for the attacks or for doing nothing to protect those waiting outside at recruitment offices. Even Adnan Pachachi, a pro-American member of the governing council, said the Americans must do more to protect Iraqis. He said the terrorists are trying to deter people from joining the new forces. Ann Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush called today for tougher international action against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Speaking at the National Defense University in Washington, Mr. Bush called for stricter controls on scientists and on nations with nuclear capability.
These materials and technologies and the people who traffic in them cross many borders. Stop this trade. The nations of the world must be strong and determined.
The president said the potential for the spread of nuclear weapons technology was highlighted by the case of a Pakistani scientist who recently admitted passing nuclear secrets to Libya and other nations. He said that Libya's recent decision to abandon its weapons program shows that proliferation can be stopped. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said today that the U.S. economy has made impressive gains since last summer that should help the job market. He warned, however, of the dangers of rising budget deficits. NPR's Paul Brown has more.
In delivering his semiannual monetary report to Congress, Greenspan said the Fed would remain patient and keep interest rates at 45-year lows for the time being to encourage the economic rebound. But he said continued budget deficits pose a danger, especially with baby boomers nearing retirement and the ratio of workers to retirees certain to get lower.
Without corrective action, this development will put substantial pressure on our ability in coming years to provide even minimal government services while maintaining entitlement benefits at their current level without debilitating increases in tax rates.
Greenspan reiterated his earlier calls to keep international trade open and resist what he called creeping protectionism or new tariffs. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 123 points, or nearly 1.2%, to close at 10,737. The Nasdaq was up 14 to 2089. This is NPR News. The cable giant Comcast has offered about $54 billion to buy the Walt Disney Company, a deal that's been refused by Disney chief Michael Eisner. Disney's board has said it would carefully evaluate the offer, which would create the world's largest media conglomerate. Comcast offered its own stock in the deal and said it would also assume about $12 billion of Disney's debt. High winds and blowing snow are hampering travel on the northern plains. Amtrak has halted service in the region, and authorities say some highways in South Dakota have drifts 3 feet high. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
The storm came down from Canada on Tuesday, and while it dropped only a couple inches of snow, it packed ice-cold winds, gusting at more than 50 miles an hour. Mark Bethke with the North Dakota Highway Patrol says visibility is the big problem. He says there was already a couple feet of snow on the ground when the storm moved in.
Much of that was extremely light, fluffy type of snow. So with the strong wind conditions, it really is blowing all of that snow around that we already had on the ground. So that really is what's creating the major hazard.
Bethke says there have been many car accidents reported, but no serious injuries. Amtrak has closed about 500 miles of rail lines between Minot, North Dakota, and Minneapolis. Two trains traveling that stretch in the morning were turned back because of blizzard conditions. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The Senate has voted down an amendment aimed at forcing states to enforce tough seatbelt laws. The measure would have denied federal highway money to states unless they passed laws allowing police officers to stop drivers whose only violation is that they aren't wearing a seatbelt. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features a variety of radios, games, and gadgets selected especially for public radio listeners at NPR.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. That's the opening of George Gershwin's second Rhapsody for piano and orchestra, performed by the Eos Orchestra. Reviving neglected works by such composers as Gershwin, Aaron Copland, Franz Schubert, and Paul Bowles is one of the missions of the orchestra. The group also prides itself on its innovative programming and collaborations. Next month, it will perform a new scaled-down adaptation of Wagner's opera The Valkyrie. My guest, Jonathan Scheffer, is the founder and artistic director of the Eos Orchestra. Before starting this New York-based orchestra in 1995, he composed and conducted scores for movies. The Eos Orchestra has several CDs and DVDs. The CD, Gershwin, Complete Works for Piano and Orchestra, features a version of Rhapsody in Blue for small orchestra, which had never been recorded before. It was arranged by Ferdy Grofe before he did the better-known larger orchestral version. In a moment, we'll hear a passage featuring saxophone and banjo that shows off what's unique about this scaled-down score. I asked Jonathan Scheffer to describe what makes it special.
This allows you to hear the music exactly as it was meant to be heard, in a sense. I think of the orchestral version as an accommodation to public taste, but I like to think of Gershwin playing this version with a small orchestra in which everybody can be heard, and certainly on this, you get a sense of that.
And this version actually was written for him to perform.
Yes. At the early parts of the piece's career, you might say, he was the only person that played it, and Oscar Levant took it up. And it was a while before other pianists really began to perform it.
Okay, well, this is the Eos Orchestra's recording of Rhapsody in Blue.
Thank you.
That's the EOS Orchestra performing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue from the EOS Orchestra's recording Gershwin, Complete Works for Piano and Orchestra. That was Michael Borskin at the piano and my guest Jonathan Scheffer conducting. He's the founder of the orchestra. Let's hear some more music. You've played a lot of Aaron Copland over the years with the EOS Orchestra, and you have two recordings of Aaron Copland music. One of those recordings, the more recent one, is music that he wrote for films. Why did you want to do an entire recording of Copland's music for film?
Well, for several reasons. One is that it's much easier to sell a recording that is focused in its repertoire and on one composer. Problem with CDs are many, but one of them is that you just don't know where to hold on to that if it isn't one composer's work. Where should I put it on my shelf? What does it mean to me? Of course, the very idea of CDs is under attack now. I happen to think that MP3 players are going to really decimate this whole idea of buying CDs. They take up a lot of space as it is. However, while people are still making CDs, we're going to keep making CDs. This one represented some research that I did at the Library of Congress, and I was very interested in Copland's film music, and I sensed that there was this gap in his work that we didn't know about. How did he get from the person that wrote Billy the Kid to the person that won an Oscar for The Heiress? How did that happen? Nobody really had looked into that, and I found in the Library of Congress all this work that he did for the World's Fair of 1939, including a short film, a documentary, that led to his work in Hollywood, and it became a project of love and of just total devotion to Aaron Copland, and it was terribly rewarding for me.
Why don't we hear something from that Celluloid Copland album that the EOS Orchestra recorded, and this is from the music that he wrote for the film The City. Well, let's start with what the film is.
The film was a documentary for the 1939 World's Fair, which was commissioned by the Hall of Science and Industry, and it was put together by a lot of very interesting left-wing intellectuals, and Copland fit very neatly into that group. And the film basically tried to describe a sort of a green city of the future, which looks to us like a suburb now, but of course in 1939 that wasn't really a concept that existed. And he provided with his first film score, very interesting and a wide range of different kinds of accompaniments for this very interesting documentary.
Well, why don't we hear an excerpt from his suite for the film The City? And this part is called Fire Engines at Lunch Hour. And listening to it, it sounded to me almost like minimalism, like a form of proto-minimalism.
Well, I think that every film composer has to do what Copland did instinctively, which is to solve the problem of quick-cutting sequences. And he took these sequences, which are all about traffic and get faster and faster, and he provided a kind of motor that does sound a bit minimalistic now to our ears. What's interesting to me is that this was a bridge to Appalachian Spring, the great masterpiece of his life, which he wrote in 1943. This score is from 1939. And I think in it he found a vocabulary that he would then apply to dance going forward, and really found its culmination in Appalachian Spring, mostly in the sections that he took out of the famous suite. But he began to develop this sort of motor sound, which I don't think really had existed in American music. So it's a terribly original kind of a piece. And you have to listen to it with those ears as though it never had existed before.
Okay, this is from Aaron Copland's score for The City from the EOS Orchestra recording Celluloid Copland.
Thank you.
That's the EOS Orchestra, conducted by my guest Jonathan Scheffer, from the album Celluloid Copeland. Well, that's just really interesting music. Did you know Aaron Copeland?
No, unfortunately, I was not really conducting when he was still alive. I really began conducting in 1991, and of course he died in 1990. And prior to that, I was working in films and in the theater.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment. You did study with Leonard Bernstein. What was his attitude toward repertoire for his concert performances? Things that you picked up on that you that have influenced your thinking when preparing repertoire.
It's interesting. He was a very bold programmer in the sense that when he was at the New York Philharmonic, he looked at an institution with an august history, and I think he said to himself, what can we do to make this more interesting to the audience? He was a great populist. He was a great educator. He was a great communicator. And he wanted the public to have a passion for classical music as much as he did. I don't think that was humanly possible. I mean, he was a man of superhuman appetites and intellect and enthusiasms. So he changed the format. He talked to the audience. There's a recording that's currently available. The Philharmonic issued a 150th anniversary CD in which he talked to the audience about a piece that he was going to play by Boulez and explained to them why it was interesting. And I always found it interesting that Leonard Bernstein would conduct Boulez, but Pierre Boulez would never conduct Leonard Bernstein. He had a great ability to listen to all kinds of music and to try to find whatever interest was in it and communicate that to his audience.
What are some of the things that, I know when you studied with him, you were at Harvard, it was before you were a conductor, and I think at that time you were aspiring to be a composer, perhaps for Broadway.
Correct.
But did you nevertheless learn things from him about conducting?
I don't like to say in two bold letters that I studied with him. I had a lot of access to him. When he was at Harvard, he taught a weekly analysis class, and some of us were invited to sit with him once a week and to talk about whatever he wanted to talk about. And it was really not about conducting. At that time, two projects loomed very large in my mind. One was his production of Carmen at the Metropolitan Opera, and the other was his composition of the Dybbuk. And he had just finished the pencil score of the Dybbuk, and he came into class, and he was so excited, and he probably had been up all night finishing it, and he grabbed one of the graduate students, and they went up to two pianos and read through it, an experience I will never forget. Also, his analysis of Carmen was so profound, it was so theatrical, it was so interesting to me that I think that has sort of worked into my musical DNA, and it will be with me forever. So in a sense, he really was teaching conducting, although he was talking about the analysis of opera arias.
Can you share something memorable from that analysis that would translate to us without hearing the score?
Yes, I can, in fact. He talked about the flower aria in Act Two, and he played a little bit of it at the piano, and he said to the class, what is unusual about this aria? And of course, we all sat there in silence. Nobody could articulate what it was. And he began to play through the entire piece, and he got to a certain point, and he said, it doesn't repeat once. There's not one phrase of music that's played twice. This is an unfolding of unrehearsed passion, and the composer understood that. I mean, that's a revelation. You need to be around somebody who can point out things like that to you in your life, and I feel fortunate that I was able to be around him.
My guest is Jonathan Scheffer, the founder, conductor, and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Scheffer, the founder, conductor, and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra, which specializes in innovative programming and the revival of neglected works. You have a CD of the music of Paul Bowles, who's really much better known as a writer, for instance, for as the writer of The Sheltering Sky. Why did you want to go back, rediscover his music?
Because it's good. Because it's fascinating to me that someone could be so good at two things. It's hard enough to be good at one thing in life. And we live in a very specialized society now. Our arts particularly are so ghettoized from each other that you can't even be a composer, a performer with a lot of success, because people will think, well, if he's a good conductor, he couldn't be a very good composer. If he's a good actor, he couldn't be a very good director. There's a lot of prejudice against people doing more than one thing. Paul Bowles didn't really care about that. What he did, he started as a composer, and he eventually found that literature had more potential for him to really express something deep in his soul. And I think he left the United States, he left New York, he left the atmosphere of Broadway, where he wrote music for a lot of plays, and the avant-garde musical world that he was living in, and he became the novelist that most of us know. So I found it fascinating, and the more I knew some of his music and the more I uncovered it, the more quality I found. It was quite a staggering process for me.
You want to play his greatest hit for us? Greatest hit, judging from the reaction you get at concerts?
I would play the third movement of the Suite for Small Orchestra. It's a very interesting combination of clashing sounds and ends in a very, very funny way, so I think that's a good thing to listen to.
Okay, so why don't we hear the end of Paul Bowles' Suite for Small Orchestra. EO's Orchestra, conducted by my guest, Jonathan Schaffer, who founded the group, from their CD, The Music of Paul Bowles. Did you get to know Paul Bowles when you were putting his music together?
I did, fortunately. When I was planning the birth of the EO's Orchestra, I got groups of friends together, and one of the people that came to one of those evenings was John Corigliano, the composer, and he said, if you want to really make a splash, you have to get Paul to come over here to New York. And that was a very important thing to hear. And I got into, I had been communicating with him, and I said, I'm going to come over to Tangier and try to talk to you about this. And I went over for a week and spent a lot of time with him, smoking keef and laughing, and had an amazing experience with him. And then it sort of sealed it, and he got very interested in coming. And when we had the festival in September of 95, he came to New York. And I think that was a real experience for everyone.
Did he offer any insights that helped you interpret his music?
Very few. But he did have a few phrasing things that we realized that his notation wasn't always as clear as it might have been. And I would look at it and try and play exactly what I thought I was seeing. And then he would sing to me what he really intended. And it was amazing to me that he remembered pieces he had written 50 years earlier that he maybe had never heard played. And so I was very interested in his reactions to having this festival built entirely around his music.
Can you sing the difference between what you thought the score said and what he meant it to say?
Yeah, he wrote his triplets with a curving line over them, which, you know, if the curving line is in the wrong place, it looks like it should be da 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 dee da da dee da 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 da. And we were recording it. We were at a recording session, and he sort of motioned me over, and he said, it's a pastorale. It's supposed to be ba 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 ba. I mean, that changes the character of the music totally.
That's certainly one of the real benefits of working with living composers, isn't it?
It's the benefit, because there's no right way except what they say.
Does the right way that they say ever not, is it ever not the way you want to play it?
Well, it's interesting. You may have a strong feeling about something and you can propose it to a composer. Being a composer myself, I would welcome somebody saying, I really feel this should be phrased this way. I really think you should change this orchestration. I think you ought to take out these four bars. You know, all of that is interesting. I orchestrated a piece that Stephen Sondheim wrote in college as his senior thesis, and he's a good friend of mine, and I felt I could make suggestions to him. I did so with care and with the greatest respect, which I have for his music, but he seemed very open to changing phrases and putting something earlier and later, and that was a very interesting collaboration. Bernstein, who we were speaking about, very often used to call up composers and explain to them what they had written. And that was very interesting.
What do you mean by that?
He was constantly switching the order of the movements of their symphonies or telling them that a certain section of the development really wasn't very convincing. And he had a great idea. Maybe if they just sort of, you know, took out 3 minutes of the piece, it would be a lot more successful. That took a lot of balls, but he was able to do that.
Jonathan Scheffer is the founder, conductor, and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra. They have several CDs and DVDs. Scheffer will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, the extraordinary World War II story of the Navy's finest hour by James D. Hornfisher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jonathan Scheffer, founder and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra. Also, the lives of undocumented workers in the U.S. We talk with David Shipler, author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Scheffer, the founder, conductor, and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra. It specializes in innovative programming and the revival of neglected works. Their recordings feature works by such composers as George Gershwin, Aaron Copland, John Cage, and Paul Bowles. When Sheffer was starting his career, he hoped to write for Broadway. When that didn't work out, he moved into television, composing for the PBS series American Playhouse. That led him to L.A., where he started writing and conducting film scores. I asked him to name a few movies he worked on.
Every bad movie you never saw. Which is really the way that... That's the way that one sort of climbs up the Hollywood ladder. I mean, the last few ones I did, Encino Man, Omen 4, I did a wonderful movie that Madonna was in that nobody saw called Bloodhounds of Broadway. And I'm very proud of these scores. I wrote a score for a film for American Playhouse called In a Shallow Grave, which was based on a James Purdy novel. And I just premiered a suite from that at Carnegie Hall at our last concert. And that was a sort of nice turning of the wheel for me because I always felt the music to that was quite good.
So even though you didn't like the movies, you liked writing the music?
Yes. The problem when you score a bad movie is that nobody really can give any credence to the music. Only in really good movies do we even begin to pay attention to the music. And I felt that I was wasting my talent, although I was learning a lot. I learned how to orchestrate. I began conducting in Hollywood with the greatest musicians in the world, and they certainly are the people that play in the studio orchestras. But I felt that that wasn't the best use of my passion. For me, it was more important to find a way to combine everything that I love, theater, movies, classical music, intellectual ideas, where are we at a concert, and then to put all of those things into one effort.
Now, you know, I sometimes think that composers are able to write pretty almost experimental music for movies because you can use that for effect. And what might sound very avant-garde in a concert hall might sound like an eerie effect or a suspenseful effect in a movie.
What is avant-garde in a concert hall is old hat in Hollywood. When you realize how technically advanced they are in California or wherever good film music is being written, how they take for granted every technique of contemporary music, and certainly every technological innovation. They were using computers long before anybody was using them. It's laughable when you think still about these efforts to use tape and to use computers to react to live performances. What they're doing in the studios in California makes that look like grade school stuff. The fact is that film music is concerned with surface, with what you just said, with sound, something sounding scary. It's all about how it sounds. I make the opposite case for concert music, where listening to a piece of music for 20 minutes is an experience of following the architecture of the composer's thought. So while the surface may gleam much more brightly in a film, it is the depth that we look for in a concert. So the two really cannot be compared. They eye each other, I think, with a certain envy, because the concert music always wants to sound as interesting as the film score, but the film score will never be as deeply interesting as the Symphony of Beethoven. Never.
Well, the film scores are so fragmented because you're writing for short scenes or for moments within scenes, and sometimes the music is like 20 seconds and...
That's true, but a symphony is nothing more than a succession of 20-second blocks. The question is, what is that succession? Beethoven worked in units of 3 seconds. The motif of the Fifth Symphony is as short as a melody as was ever written, but look what he did with it. A good film score can proceed in short blocks to be a totality. Very few composers have been able to do it. John Corigliano has done it. Aaron Copland has done it. Philip Glass does it. These people write in a way that is consistent for their style as concert composers, yet works in a film.
So you learn to conduct while conducting for the movies. Are there certain special techniques that you needed to learn for the movies that you really don't need to know on stage, but are useful to know anyways and that you've learned from?
Yes, many. And there are many that I did not learn, which I had to learn when I began to conduct only concerts. But from conducting films, I learned to be clear in my beat, to be simple in my instruction to the players, and also I learned how to be consistent. Because when we work without a click track, then you have to be able to reproduce a performance to the tenth of a second, and to be able to catch an action in a film it teaches you tremendous flexibility, which you can then apply to something like opera, because that is another medium where flexibility of that type is required. What conducting for films does not teach you is performance tradition and the experience of conducting a long work. And that requires an emotional maturity, and it requires a kind of vision that has nothing to do with the technical aspects of conducting.
And concentration probably too.
Yes, actually, when we did The Rheingold, which was my first really long opera, I found it exhausting, and that's the shortest of Wagner's operas. I mean, this is something that requires physical and emotional stamina, and we're going to do The Valkyrie this year, and I'm already, you know, going to the gym just to get ready for that.
Really? You have to pump up for the conducting?
It's not sort of pumping up muscles as much as it is really having the stamina emotionally and physically, and I was exhausted from The Rheingold.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about these productions of Wagner that you're doing. Certainly for The Rheingold, you updated it. You made it more contemporary. Are you doing that for The Valkyrie too?
We did it in the staging, but the musical approach is very unique. It's based on a production that was done in England in the early 90s, reduced for 18 players, which sounds absurd when we tell this to people. But a composer, Jonathan Dove, has very cleverly retained every soloistic aspect of the opera's orchestration and added an organ, which creates this very deep and interesting sound. For the staging, it's completely contemporary, and my partner in this project is Christopher Alden, a marvelous stage director, and he believes, as I do, that opera staging needs to provoke and it needs to be spoken in a contemporary vernacular, because I've really come to the feeling that conservative productions of opera do nothing for the art of opera. They can be very pleasing to watch, but ultimately, we're living in a time in which flattering the conservative taste of the audience really doesn't do much for the art form.
So what's the difference in the way the music is sung? Is the singing any different than it would have been in a more traditional approach?
Well, Wagner can only be performed in large opera houses because of the size of the orchestra, and therefore it has traditionally been the domain of singers with enormously loud voices with great stamina. This approach is slightly different. The theater we'll be in is the new theater at NYU. It's about 800 seats, I think, with a smaller orchestra. It allows us to sing in a way that isn't quite as grand as is required in most Wagner singing. We have Sanford Silvan, a great baritone, mm-hmm. who's going to be singing Wotan. This is not a role he could do in any other production in the world. And there's a great deal of interest in this production because of that, because of his taking that role and all the other singers we've cast.
You know, Wagner has all these political implications. Hitler really liked Wagner. So is that something that affects your choice in doing Wagner and your approach to doing Wagner?
I'm really a fan of doing Wagner in the way that we do it because of the very thing I said earlier, which is that conventional stagings of Wagner tend to be a throwback to a time in which Wagner was more contentious, in which it was closer to the time of Nazi Germany. And I get a little creeped out when people in tuxedos in Germany applaud singers dressed in the way that they did at the time of Hitler. I don't enjoy it. In fact, one of my most interesting experiences with Wagner was last year I went to the Bavarian State Opera in Munich and saw a new production of Siegfried by Christopher Alden's twin brother, David Alden, who is also an opera director. And they work in a very similar style. And here you have the seat of Nazism. And I was sitting in the box in the first ring in the center, and you know who liked to sit there. And this production was so interesting and so modern and so frightening to this audience. The boos, which probably from a minority of the audience, but extremely loud, were thrilling to me because I thought this is a way that opera can actually provoke. Wagner has the power to do that. I happen to feel that Wagner ought to be played in Israel. I think that education has to accompany that act. But I think that to not play Wagner in Israel is to give Nazism dominion. It continues to do that. I'm not in that debate. I'm not in a position to perform there or to say more than I'm saying right now, but I feel very passionately that we repossess artists by the way that we interpret their work. And the best thing that we can do in the world is to say, we acknowledge the anti-Semitism of Wagner. We don't want to dwell on that. Let's play the music, and let's have it on our terms. And that, to me, is the victory over history.
Well, Jonathan Schaeffer, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Jonathan Schaeffer is the founder, conductor, and artistic director of the EOS Orchestra. Their recordings include neglected works by Aaron Copland, George Gershwin, and Paul Bowles. The EOS production of The Valkyrie will be performed March 18th and 20th at NYU. Here's an excerpt of their production of Wagner's The Rheingold, featuring Wendy Hill, Beth Clayton, and Linda Pavelka as the Rhine Maidens. Coming up, journalist David Shipler talks about his new book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America. This is Fresh Air. In his new book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America, David Shipler writes about the people he describes as living at the bottom of the working world, the people who serve you Big Macs, help you find merchandise in Walmart, harvest your food, clean your offices, and sew your clothes. Shipler reported for The New York Times from 1966 to 1988. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land. He spent over 5 years researching his new book on the working poor. President Bush has proposed giving renewable visas to illegal immigrants. Would you explain his proposal?
Well, I think the details of his proposal have yet to be outlined sufficiently to know how helpful it will be. I think the idea is good in the sense that it seems to reconcile both the human interest and the American economic interest. I mean, I remember a few years ago, I was in Maine in the summer, and hearing two news reports on the radio back to back. The first extolled the wonders of the current blueberry crop. It's a big deal in Maine, and it was a great year for blueberries. The second reported on roadblocks that had been set up by the immigration officials and state police on the Maine Turnpike to intercept undocumented workers who were coming to pick the blueberry crop. It was a perfect example of the country working at cross purposes with itself. We need the labor, and yet we make life very difficult for people who try to fulfill those roles. So I think that the basic concept of legalizing immigrants who are here to work is a good one. The question is whether it can be done without making them beholden to certain employers, because that will create an exploitative relationship that exists already economically, but it will simply formalize it through government. I think also because, most immigrants who are here in an undocumented status move from job to job. I mean, they don't stay in one job very long. Many of the jobs are seasonal. Migrant workers especially, but even in Los Angeles, where I spent some time in the garment district, there are lots of fly-by-night sewing shops, often called sweatshops, where people are also paid on a piecework basis. And sometimes these companies will evaporate overnight or over the weekend, and the workers will come in Monday morning and find nobody there, and they are still owed a week's pay. And then the companies will reconstitute themselves, down the block under a different name and that sort of thing. So if this visa idea relies on some kind of permanent or long-term employer-employee relationship, it won't work. And people on both sides, that is, employers and employees, will simply evade it.
You visited the garment district in Los Angeles. What are some of the working conditions that you found there?
The working conditions in the garment district in Los Angeles vary from decent to outrageous. The decent places are, by and large, the designers who pay their people a bit better, who cut the pieces of the clothing, and then they send those pieces in stacks to the sewing contractors. And the sewing contractors also vary, but many of them are very, very poor places. There are these buildings, 10, 12-story buildings in L.A. Some of them are poorly ventilated. People are crowded together. They get paid very often on a piecework basis. This little amount per fly that they sew into a pair of trousers, and they have to sew X number in order to get the minimum wage, and the minimum wage is not always attainable at that rate. There are no benefits. They're paid only when they're at work. So if there isn't work by the company, they're simply told not to bother to come in, which means that they're not basically working a full day or a full week. So even if they make the minimum wage, it doesn't come out to a living wage for sure. Minimum wage wouldn't anyway, but it doesn't come out to anything close to what you would imagine was needed to support a family.
What populations were working in these factories?
In the factories in L.A., you saw a lot of Latinos and Asians primarily. People from Korea, Hong Kong, Mexico, Guatemala. There were also some European Americans, but not very many. Most of the people I saw who were workers were minorities and mostly immigrants.
Would you guess that this represents any kind of change in American working conditions? Would you guess that there have always been sweatshops that garment workers have to work in, but the population of the people in those sweatshops have changed? Or do you think that the working conditions have gotten different?
I think there's always been one particular sector of the garment industry like this. But what's happened in the last 20 years is that so many of these sewing jobs have gone overseas that most of the clothing that we wear in the United States, my guess is, has been assembled abroad. The garment district in L.A. handles clothing where designers don't want to wait the time it takes to send their design or even their material overseas and then have it shipped back. They're a little more sensitive to fads and fashions, and they need the clothing produced more quickly. So those are, I think, mainly the kind of garment factories that you find in L.A. I would add that the decline of unions in the United States has had an impact in the garment industry and other industries. There are garment workers, especially in New York, who are unionized. There are some in L.A. who are unionized in other parts of the country. But increasingly, there's been a development of these very small sewing factories, often run by immigrants themselves, that appear and then disappear after a few months. And the workers in those are not members of any labor union, so they don't get any kind of union wage or benefits.
Did you talk to any of the employers who own the sweatshops that you visited in Los Angeles?
I talked to, employers who own the sweatshops would not talk to me. But I did talk to a couple who own better places, and who railed against the sweatshops, by the way, who didn't like the sweatshops because they undercut cut them in terms of cost. In other words, if you want to pay your workers decently, you're going to have to charge a bit more per item of clothing. And it's very hard to compete with the sweatshops that are exploiting workers just down the hall sometimes.
So they were in a bind, these employers were in a bind about whether to pay a better wage and maybe go out of business because they couldn't be competitive, or stay competitive and feel that they're exploiting their workers.
They were in a bind, in a way. One fellow struck me particularly. He was an immigrant from some 20, 30 years ago from Beirut, Lebanon, and he had a small sewing company that did very high-end evening gowns and so forth. And he had a pretty stable workforce, all women who were very good sewers, highly skilled. And he was paying them a little bit better. He was paying them, I think, $8 to $10 an hour. That's pretty high for garment workers. But as a result, labor was a huge percentage of his cost, and therefore he had to charge more to the designers who, you know, wanted him to put together their garments. And it was very hard to compete with the people down the hall. I mean, he told me he used to hire undocumented workers, and now he hires only documented workers, and he hates the competitors who hire undocumented workers because they pay less and they can undercut him. However, he has carved out a little bit of a niche for himself in that he does very elaborate and high-quality work, whereas some of the less expensive places throw things together pretty quickly.
My guest is David Shipler, author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Shipler, and his new book is called The Working Poor, Invisible in America. One accusation against the immigrant workforce, particularly the undocumented workforce, is that some workers and I think some unions would say that it keeps wages down. What were your thoughts about that issue after having investigated so many facets of the working poor?
I'll tell you my thought about that. My thought is that wages are always going to be very low at a certain unskilled level of the economy. And the key issue here is to open pathways to advancement and improvement and education and training. There's no way that American workers can compete globally if they are doing very menial work, because you have to have a fairly high income in the United States to live decently, and you don't in Cambodia or Sri Lanka. And therefore, if the same jobs are being done here as in Cambodia, the American worker is always going to be at a disadvantage. So the answer is really not preventing jobs from going overseas, because jobs are like water, they flow to the cheapest level. The answer is to make sure that we have a workforce in this country that has opportunity and training so that people can advance. Our educational system really doesn't provide for that now. We've decimated our vocational school structure because we have this idea that everyone ought to go to college. Well, that sounds great, but if everyone goes to college, then we're not going to have anybody to do the menial jobs that also need to be done. But beyond that, not everybody does go to college. And if the high schools prepare people only for college and people then don't go, if they either graduate from high school and go into the job force, or if they drop out of high school, or even if they go to college for a year or two and drop out, which many do, you have a whole population of unskilled folks, basically, who really can't make their way in the workplace and have no educational structure to move back into and advance through, except some job training programs, which are good, but need more federal funding.
We're in a presidential election year. You point out in your book that nobody needs the government more than the poor, yet no population is as underrepresented in the vote as the poor.
I think it's fair to say, I mean, you know, if all those under 10,000 a year, or say under 25,000, let's say, a year voted at the same rate as those who are wealthier, you'd have more than 6 million additional voters. If they voted according to their interests, political candidates would really have to take notice of this problem or this whole set of problems and address them, because they'd have to appeal to these folks, because they're the swing voters, in effect. They're the silent voters who could make or break a particular candidate. There's almost no state where a candidate for president wins with more than 5% of the vote. So these folks, if they voted in a block according to their own interests, would really make a difference. But why don't they vote? Well, I think there are lots of different reasons. I asked everybody. I just talked to a fellow in New Hampshire, Tom King, who I followed for many, many years, his family, and he didn't vote in the New Hampshire primary. And I said, how come? He said, I was looking for a job. He got laid off 3 weeks ago from a boot factory, and he doesn't have any work. Now, I'm sure Tom could have found a half an hour to go to the polling place and vote during that day, but he's never felt that politics makes any difference to him. He can't make a connection between who gets elected and how his life is going to change. So, and I think that's pretty common for lots of people in this situation. They don't feel that their vote really is going to have an impact on the way they live.
David Shipler, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure to be with you, Terry.
David Shipler's new book is called The Working Poor, Invisible in America. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toyota and the Next Generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves, and from Nonsuch Records, featuring mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson's recording of Bach cantatas numbers 82 and 199. More information available at nonsuch.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Richard Cohn. He's reported from war zones. His new memoir, Blindsided, is about his own psychological war with illness. He was diagnosed with MS 30 years ago. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.